You are listening to a sermon by Kevin Hebert, recorded on Sunday, April 12, 2015, at the Point Grey Intermennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org. All for one and one for all is the phrase most often heard when someone wants to evoke the spirit of togetherness, unity, and mutual aid. Most people quote it from The Three Musketeers, but in French it's written the other way around, one for all for one. And the German and Latin phrases that became the motto of Switzerland in the late 19th century are inverted that way too. Even earlier, at the outbreak of the Thirty Years' War in 1618, one of the Protestant lords from the Bohemian estates surrounding Prague said to their rivals, the Catholic regents of King Matthias, "We would stand firm with all for one and one for all, nor would we be subservient, but rather we would loyally help and protect each other to the utmost against all difficulties." Shortly before throwing three of them out the seventh floor window to barely survive by apparently landing on a dung heap. But don't worry, this morning I won't be tossing anyone out of a window. But I will use the lectionary text to explore how our spiritual lives and our economic lives are intertwined with each other, and how doing so in unison, or is it harmony, is good and pleasing to God. From the first letter of John, I will show that fellowship equals leadership plus followership. From Psalm 133, well, we heard that living together in unity is a blessing as refreshing as the morning dew. And from Acts chapter 3, we'll see that you don't have to be a communist to know what it will take for the poor to receive consolation and be fed by us. In the book Cool, How the Brain's Hidden Quest for Cool Drives Our Economy and Shapes Our World, the authors, Stephen Quartz and Annette Asp, conducted an experiment at Caltech in which they asked a group of design students to rate a variety of images, cars, clothes, bottled water, etc., as hot or not, and then showed the same images to another set of aspiring designers while scanning their brains with an MRI machine. The scan showed that when the second group of students saw an image that had, without their knowledge, been deemed trendworthy, their prefrontal cortexes went into overdrive. The frontal section of the brain handles tasks such as self-reflection and plays a crucial role in helping us to shape our identities. As the Harvard Business Review writer Kevin Evers put it when he wrote the article, "This Is Your Brain on Cool," unique and compelling ideas aren't just catnip for our egos, they make us want to connect with others, to feel that we have partners. Followership is the capacity of an individual to actively follow a leader. In the emerging field of followership, as described by the scholar Robert Kelly, effective followers are competent, committed, courageous, and able to work independently. In John 1, verse 3, we heard the apostle say, "We declare to you what we have seen and heard, so that you also may have fellowship with us. And truly, our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ." Notice the connection between new converts hearing the good news and fellowshipping with the existing believers. As the apostles witness to what they have seen and heard, they create a community of like-minded individuals who hear that story and accept the message of Emmanuel, God with us. The one thing that we all have in common is our fallen nature, our propensity to sin. In verses 6 and 7, we heard, "If we say that we have fellowship with him while we are walking in darkness, we lie and do not do what is true. But if we walk in the light, as himself is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus, his Son, cleanses us from all sin." Our leader in the way is Christ, whom Ernest Strubhar from Perkins, Oklahoma, described as the front wheel on the tricycle of Anabaptism at the 10th Annual Anabaptism Identity Conference in Indiana in early March. The way has to do with our walk, our conduct, our lifestyle, how we live to become Christ's disciples in training, said Strubhar, an elder at the Cimarron Christian Fellowship. The two rear wheels of the tricycle are characterized as the truth and the life. Essential, of course, but not what steers our faith. Over 400 people attended the conference, which included a speech by an Amish minister, Chester Weaver, about the dangers of fundamentalism that has made it acceptable to consider those who believe differently as enemies, which is incompatible with historic Anabaptist precept of self-surrender, called Gelassenheit in German. In Moravia, now eastern Czechoslovakia, the Philippite Brethren published a tract called Concerning the True Soldier of Christ in 1534, which explained Gelassenheit by saying that when we truly realize the love of God, we will be ready to give up, for love's sake, even what God has given us. The nearby Hutterites used the concept of Gelassenheit to support relinquishing all but a few personal belongings to the common purse of the group, demonstrating that by overcoming all selfishness, a community of love was possible. In the magazine Relevant, there was an article called What Christians Get Wrong About Discipleship. And Swindell makes the case that discipleship isn't easy, it isn't mentoring, that's learning from someone else's wisdom or experience, it doesn't require a certain method, and it isn't just about you and Jesus. It's intentionally partnering with other Christians to help each other obey Jesus and grow in relationship with him. If you try to follow @Jesus on Twitter, you'll get bizarre quips from some guy named Jesus. So I recommend that you actually follow Jesus in the way that John 1, verse 7 says, "Walk in the light, have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus, his Son, cleanses us from all sin." The Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, an intellectual venture capitalist, has a research program looking into social interactions, identity, and well-being, which is finding that group identity affects many forms of behavior. Suicide rates are lower in Aboriginal communities that have self-government, and therefore stronger group identification, compared to those that do not. Employees become more productive and satisfied when they have greater input into the design of their workspace. Senior citizens adapt more effectively to moves into long-term care facilities if they maintain memberships in formal clubs or informal groups of friends. I like how Irvin Stutzman, executive director of Mennonite Church USA, put it at the recent meeting of the Constituency Leaders Council after its endorsement of a statement of unity on the contentious matters related to same-sex covenanted unions. He said, "I realize that organizational unity itself is not the unity of the spirit. I wish we could stay together as a church, but if we don't, I hope we cultivate the kinds of relationships that show the unity of the spirit. There are some who are so committed to Mennonite Church USA that you couldn't push them out with a bulldozer, and there are some so eager to leave that you couldn't hold them in with a net." Last month, the state of Utah passed two bills, one banning discrimination against lesbians, gays, bisexuals, and transgender people, and one protecting the rights of those who object to same-sex marriage on religious grounds. After 2013, but before the bills passed this year, a court clerk could get an exemption from handling same-sex marriage licenses only if it does not cause a hardship for the couple. Now, if a clerk gets an exemption, it is the duty of the state to find a replacement clerk so that the marriage license can be issued. This was an unprecedented compromise for a state that had a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage since 2005 until it was overturned federally in 2013. In Psalm 133, we heard how very good and pleasant it is when kindred live together in unity. Even though I wear a goatee, I'm not going to explore the analogy of precious oil running down from Aaron's head to his beard and over the collar of his robes. Luckily, the psalmist gave us another image with which to understand the joys of unified living, a blessing as refreshing as the morning dew. In verse 3, Mount Hermon refers to the snow-capped mountains on the border between Lebanon and Syria, whose southern slopes include a ski resort on the Israeli-occupied portion of the Golan Heights. At an elevation of 2,814 meters, the Hermon Hotel is the highest permanently staffed UN station in the world, overlooking an area of separation, buffer zone, that was created after the Yom Kippur War in 1974. The dew of Hermon is too far away to literally fall on Mount Zion, a hill in Jerusalem just outside the walls of the old city. But in his exposition of the Bible, John Gill wrote about Psalm 133, saying, "The dew also fell in great plenty, and to which unity among brethren is here compared, because it comes from God in heaven, as the dew does. Saints are taught of God to love one another. Contentions and quarrels come from lusts within. But this comes from above, from the Father of lights. And because of its gentle nature, this makes men pure and peaceable and gentle and easy to be entreated. As the dew falls gently in a temperate and moderate air, not in stormy and blustering weather. And because of its cooling nature, it allays the heats and animosities of the minds of men. And because it makes the saints fruitful and to grow and increase in good works. For there the Lord commanded blessing." After I lived in the Menno Simon Center from the fall of 1990 to the spring of 92, I rented a six-bedroom house on West 15th Avenue with a group of friends and a few strangers until 1994, when I moved to a three-bedroom house on West 41st with two of them. The experiences I had in living together as harmoniously as possible, with such different personalities and varying hobbies and standards of cleanliness, taught me that it could only have been a gift from God that we didn't drive each other nuts. Those years were a real blessing to me, with a sense of belonging to an extended community. The passage we heard from Acts 4 about the believers sharing their possessions is sometimes known as the Christian Communist Experiment. Michael Grenholm's ebook, God vs. Inequality, Wealth, Poverty, and the Bible, contains 59 pages of biblical and economic research that make a good case for why thinking that you can ignore what the Bible teaches by labeling it communism is just false logic. Grenholm is a Menno Nerds blogger with a number of proposals that sound radical until you look at the biblical support for not accumulating wealth and avoiding conspicuous consumption. The Anabaptist values of simplicity and contentment are countercultural in promoting a spirituality of sufficiency. Not self-sufficiency, but empowering aid, as demonstrated by the Mennonite Central Committee's kit-making projects for toiletries, infant care, sewing, and school supplies that are being sent primarily to afflicted areas of the Middle East and Eastern Europe right now. Derek Cook, a social planner in Calgary and board member of Canada Without Poverty, wrote an article last month in the Canadian Mennonite entitled "Healing the Wounded City, Why Jesus Didn't Talk Very Much About the Poor," in which he says that poverty isn't so much a problem to be fixed as it is a wound to be healed. Poverty separates. Poverty isolates. Poverty engenders guilt, shame, and accusations. Poverty creates fear and helplessness. If poverty is a wound in the fabric of the community, it is a community of which we are all a part, and so we are all wounded. In the Beatitudes, as told in Luke 6, verses 20 to 22, the poor are not identified as uniquely blessed, but are one of four categories of people, along with the hungry, the weeping, and the despised, who are contrasted with those who deserve woe in verses 23 to 26 for being currently rich, full, laughing, or well-regarded. Again, Derek Cook challenges us by saying, we idolize the self-made man or woman and the ideal of self-reliance, seeing ourselves and each other as competitors in this game with scarce resources in which we must fight for our share. When we buy into this notion of scarcity, we fail to acknowledge God as our sustainer and the source of our abundance. So too, when we buy into the myth of our self-reliance, we willingly deny the reality that nobody has done it alone, since we are all interdependent, existing within the bonds of community, humbly dependent on God and each other. The sixth core conviction of Stuart Murray's book, The Naked Anabaptist, is that economics and spirituality are connected for reasons of justice other than charity. Committing ourselves to mutual aid means that we must recognize the needs of others and confront the fact that charitable gifts can't entirely make up for the pervasive individualism in our lifestyle choices. In 1 John 3:17, we can read, "How does God's love abide in anyone who has the world's goods and sees a brother or sister in need and yet refuses to help?" How does our obsession with lower taxes impact the ability of the government to provide adequate shelter allowances to welfare recipients? Does BC really need to have the fourth lowest average income tax rate in the country for someone making $100,000 a year, beating every province except the three northern ones? How about middle of the pack instead? Would that raise enough money to at least partly address the homeless problem? I'll start our conversation for the response time with a challenging list of a few examples from the 40 mindless ways you're burning through your paycheck, and ask us to think about whether or not we would be more inclined to help the needy around us if we freed up some money from our personal finance budgets. Number four, buying bottled water and coffee. The markups are huge. Sometimes the portions are wastefully big. Number six, shopping without a list. Beware of impulse purchases. Number 10, buying brand name products instead of equivalent generic brands. Number 16, buying lunch at work. Try brown bagging it. Number 30, always buying new when refurbished or used is just as good. Well, it's a good thing I always announce a disclaimer at the beginning of our sermon recordings, because I could get in trouble for some of this. These opinions are my own and do not reflect the views of my employer. Proverbs 30, verse 8 says, "Give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread."